Hello, you are listening to an episode of Trade Talks, a podcast about the economics of trade policy. I'm Sameya Keynes, economics and trade correspondent for The Economist in London.
And I'm Chad Bown, senior fellow with the Peterson Institute for International Economics in Washington.
This episode is about something called the Generalized System of Preferences. We'll refer to it as GSP, apologies for the acronym. So it's this scheme where rich countries say, hey, you look like you could do with a helping hand, poor country. Here are some lower tariffs to help you develop. So the US has a version, the GSP, but it expired on December the 31st of last year. The Trump administration seems keen to revive it, but who knows how long that could take.
This is a scheme with some really good intentions behind it. And in this episode, we're going to explain whether the program works. Or we'll try.
Okay, so first, some more details on what this thing actually is. So, it's a system where rich countries give low tariffs to poor ones. It's unilateral. There's no negotiation here. The rich country just drops their tariffs unilaterally. So, the World Trade Organization database lists 12 of these schemes around the world. It includes Canada, Switzerland, Turkey. But the two biggest ones, by far, are the American one and the EU one. Before it expired, the American system offered 120 countries concessions and then extra concessions for 44 least developed countries. The EU is a bit choosier about who they give the concessions to, so it's slightly narrower. And then both countries have sort of different levels or slightly different iterations of the scheme. So the US has a special scheme that it offers to African countries called the AGOA. The EU has a thing called the GSP Plus, which is like the GSP but better, and also the EBA, which is everything but arms, which is a special thing, again, for the very poorest countries, which is a bit more generous than the standard GSP. And then around the world, you might be surprised to hear that countries like India and China have their own schemes. So they offer these low tariffs to the least developed countries, though in some cases it can be a bit ad hoc in terms of who they actually give these to.
And so in the United States, their version of this program is obviously it isn't permanent. Right now, it hasn't been renewed. So every time that it's up, it has to actually get renewed by the U.S. Congress. And so what that means is in practice, it tends to expire a lot. In the 1990s, it actually expired six different times. And individual senators and congresspeople can hold things up. So in 2010, it expired when President Trump's current attorney general, Jeff Sessions, at that point he was a senator from Alabama, blocked it. Sessions wanted sleeping bags to be removed from the program because he had a sleeping bag company in his state of Alabama that didn't want to compete with sleeping bags that were imported from Bangladesh. And this held up the bill for nearly a year. And in 2013, it expired again, and that time for over 2 years, though it wasn't over sleeping bags.
Okay, so this time there's been a statement from a White House official to say that the administration supports a three-year reauthorization of GSP and hopes to get it done early this year. And importers under the scheme can be comforted that in the past, when it's been reintroduced or renewed, they've had all the tariffs that they had to pay refunded. But aside from all the kind of politics and questions about what the Trump administration will do, there's a bigger question, which is, should we care? Is this a good scheme? That does seem to sort of fundamentally matter here.
So let's take a step back. So this generalized system of preferences was an idea first popularized in the 1960s, and behind it was, hey, we need something to help promote economic development for poor countries. By exporting higher value-added products rather than staple things, this was a way to help poorer countries enjoy export-led growth. But the basic idea from developing countries is they thought a system that had equal treatment for everybody just wasn't good enough, that actually gave an unfair advantage to the richer and more powerful countries. So what they proposed was a new system in which the rich countries would cut their tariffs on imports coming in from the poorer countries, but not the other way around. And their argument was, hey, we actually need import protection to help promote our infant industries.
Yeah, you still hear that now, you know, the idea that their industries aren't ready to be subjected to the tough competition from the richer ones. Okay, but keen Trade Talks listeners will have picked up by now that this idea of dropping tariffs to some countries and not others kind of goes against a pretty fundamental principle within the World Trade Organization, the principle of most favored nations. That system essentially says everyone should be treated the same. This is the opposite. This is treating some countries differently to others, giving them special carve-outs. Agreeing to this scheme actually required countries to officially agree this carve-out to the system of global trading rules, then known as the GATT. But it also goes against a principle underlying trade negotiations for decades, which is this idea of reciprocity. Normally, countries sort of exchange carrots. They say, I'll lower my tariffs if you lower yours. This didn't do that. The poorer countries didn't have to change their behavior. They just had to fulfill some rather broad, vague criteria about not abusing human rights or having good labor laws or not being a communist country, not stealing intellectual property, that sort of thing.
So that's the theory behind this thing. But the practicalities are actually really important for determining how it is that it actually works in practice. So back in the 1970s, when these preference programs were introduced, the rich country governments couldn't agree on a one-size-fits-all program for how these preferences should work. So what they did is they allowed themselves to pick and choose which products that they were actually going to offer the lower tariffs on and how it was that they were going to do it. So in the United States, what the Americans do is they do offer tariff cuts all the way to zero. In 2016, the biggest products that enjoyed these kinds of preferences were non-alcoholic beverages, gold necklaces, and of course, rubber gloves. So not super politically sensitive products by any means. In the European Union, their system's a little bit different. They don't offer tariff cuts all the way to zero. They offer smaller tariff cuts, but they offer them on a broader range of products. But in general, what these rich countries have done is they've really excluded the sensitive products. But which products are sensitive differs by the importing country. So Japan, for example, excludes rice. Here's Emily Blanchard describing the U.S. Trade Act of 1974 that created the American program.
And that act carves out a lot of no-go zones for GSP preferences. So there are whole countries, whole classifications of countries, and huge swaths of industries that are not included, written right there in the act as not allowed to be GSP eligible under any circumstances. So for example, watches, footwear, handbags, most leather goods, crucially for developing countries, no textile or apparel goods. Agriculture is almost entirely out of GSP.
Governments also have their own ideas about which countries should be eligible. So the GSP isn't just the least developed countries. The US offers preferences to countries like India and Brazil, though not China. The US and the EU both attach conditions for eligibility. So Argentina got suspended from the US scheme in 2012 when it stopped paying out money owed to US investors when it lost an investor-state dispute. And in the US, the most common reasons for suspension are intellectual property violations, labor rights violations, and if the country just had a coup, then that will get you kicked off. The EU's GSP Plus scheme is supposed to promote good governance. And so there you get better preferences if you show that you're living up to things like certain environmental standards. I think overall, it's probably fair to say that it's unclear how consistently these criteria are enforced. It's unclear whether they are often enforceable. And I was talking to Kim Elliott of the Center for Global Development, and she pointed out that because it's not clear how and when these things are going to be implemented, that makes it really difficult to use these eligibility criteria as good incentives.
The Clinton administration tried to promote worker rights using GSP in the 1990s with only very limited success. There were some minor changes to relatively technical labor regulations in some cases, but there were very few cases of sustained change in more politically difficult areas like child labor and forced labor.
Even if you're in a poor country and you're making something that's included under a rich country's low tariff program, your product might not even be let in. There are rules of origin, so a certain fraction of the value of what you make has to be made up of inputs from the country in which you're supplying it. And if the local inputs are too expensive, that might not work. There are also limits. So if a product that you make is too competitive, so it takes up too high a share of the rich country's imports under this scheme, it can get ditched entirely. So in the United States, no more than 50% of a product entering in under GSP can come in from any single poor country. And the maximum amount of a product that one of these poor countries can sell into the American market under the zero tariff is also limited. So in 2017, it was capped at $180 million. The thinking of this is, if you're that competitive, then maybe you don't actually need the program. But a problem with the design of the American program is that it actually forces developing countries to actually police themselves so that they don't go over these limits, both individually and also collectively. And anytime you have more than one firm that's actually exporting these products, well, that means you then need to talk to all the other firms that are doing it to make sure that you don't collectively go over the edge, in which case everyone gets kicked out of the program. And when you get kicked out of the program, it's not only getting kicked out for that year, but the following years as well.
This is not a big scheme from the US perspective. There's about $19 billion of imports that entered duty-free under the program. That's less than 1% of the total. And it's less than 3% of the total that would actually be subject to tariffs if there weren't any preferences. The top countries exporting under the scheme are places like India and Brazil, but for those big exporters, the scheme accounts for a tiny fraction of their exports. Mostly, they're just exporting under the WTO rules or maybe just under different schemes. The EU scheme is slightly broader for certain products. So in 2016, about a fifth of its textiles imports came in under the GSP, also a fifth of footwear, headgear and umbrellas. But for other products, it's also really small. So 2.5% of vegetable products came in under the GSP. From the poorer countries' perspective, we know that in some cases they don't actually use the preferences that they are eligible for. So there's data from the EU that shows that poorer countries only actually use 69% of the preferences available. So 31% of the exports that could be eligible for lower tariffs, they just end up exporting under the WTO rules tariffs. So maybe they're not benefiting as much as they might from the scheme.
There is an increasing body of economic research to look into the question of whether these programs actually work. A recent review of the European Union's schemes found that these unilaterally given preferences did seem to work at boosting exports. So a study by Copenhagen Economics and Johannes van Biesbroek looked at the impact of EU preferences under their GSP, GSP Plus, and the Everything But Arms programs. And they used some pretty serious econometrics and find that these preferential tariffs did boost exports. Now, it's not huge. For an average product, the tariff preference was about 4 percentage points, and the exports of these eligible products increased by slightly more than 1% because of the preference. So it's not a huge effect, but it looks like these preferences can actually work. And looking at the different schemes, the Everything But Arms scheme seemed to have a bigger effect than GSP, and that's at some level what we would hope to see, poorer countries being able to take bigger advantage of it. Also likely because that scheme is broader, covers more products, but also because the tariff preferences are going to be deeper as well.
That EU study actually builds from an earlier study by Jo van Biesbroek and also Garth Fraser from 2010. And they look at the AGOA scheme, which isn't the American GSP scheme, but it's that more generous one that is for African countries. So they look at 207 countries over 8 years and 5,000 products, and they find that this scheme did significantly increase exports from these AGOA countries to the US. The effects seem quite big, actually. So receiving this treatment increases US imports by about 13% over the time period that they consider. So looking at specific sectors, they find that apparel increased by 42%. Minerals by 74%. So the question of whether these schemes increase exports is quite a narrow one. I think what we would really like to know is, do these schemes increase diversification? Do they encourage development? Do they promote industrialization? That sort of thing. And it's much, much harder to find good evidence of that just because it's a much bigger question. So that study of the EU that Chad mentioned does find that tariff preferences raise the chances that a particular product included under the scheme would be exported, which could be seen as a sign of diversification. But I think more broadly, there have been literature reviews of this. There was one from Emmanuel Ornelas in 2016, and he found that, you know, empirical support for this idea that it fostered export-led growth to be weak at best. I'm probably in the camp that says that's not the fault of the schemes. It's probably just because this kind of question is really difficult to answer. But still, it doesn't really seem like these policies have so far single-handedly solved the development problem.
I think that's right. These schemes are unlikely to be transformative, partly because they are so small. So remember, under the U.S. Generalized System of Preferences scheme, it's really only about 10% of the imports from the countries that are eligible that are actually receiving these preferences. And in a lot of these products, these countries have low tariffs anyway because of their WTO commitments and the lower tariffs that they give out under free trade agreements. So in a lot of cases, there really aren't a lot of preferences to actually give. In the United States, about half of imported products already have zero MFN tariffs. So you combine that with the fact that under GSP, unlike the AGOA program, clothing, textiles, agricultural products are all stripped out. There's just not that much there.
There are some specific successes. I don't want us to be too down on these schemes. So the Congressional Research Service pointed out India and Thailand, who were able to expand the reach of their jewelry industries. And everyone I've spoken to who uses the scheme, lots of American importers, talk about seeing the increase in the standard of living among the factories that they source from. So when they first started, they remembered the people working in these developing countries all walking to work or using bicycles. And now everyone has their own moped, and some people in management even have cars. There are some bigger questions, or I suppose worries, about how sustainable these success stories are. So you worry that if an industry is only competitive because of the tariff preference, and when it's removed, maybe they'll just be chucked back to square one. So I spoke to an American importer called Nina Cooper, who is importing silver jewelry from Thailand and Indonesia. And so actually the Thailand is graduating out of the US scheme because it's too rich. And she said, oh, actually, that they're quite efficient, so she wasn't going to change her sourcing. But it's quite hard to tell if that's because of the duty, you know, whether the scheme had led to that, whether it always would have been efficient. And I spoke to a different guy who said that he was shifting his sourcing from Thailand to Cambodia because Cambodia got tariff preferences on these things that he was importing, whereas Thailand didn't. There is actually some more academic research. Shushanik Hakobayan, in a paper from 2014, looked at what happened when one of these limits was reached, right? So the idea was if a product is competitive, then it doesn't need the preference anymore. And if that's true, then you would expect the expiry not to have much of an effect on the level of exports. They should just be able to carry on going because now they're competitive. She doesn't actually tend to find that. So she finds that when the share threshold is reached, so when a product has more than a certain share of the American market and the preference is removed, exports actually fall. That result suggests that these limit criteria are excluding the very products that actually still need the preferences to be exported. She does find that when a product is excluded simply because the volume of the exports has become so large, then there isn't a negative effect on their exports. So that could be evidence of the scheme working. But generally, it's a really hard question to answer, and it's probably not consistent across all products and all industries.
So in some cases, it could work really well, but in others, it might not be working because of the way in which the program is actually designed. So in the American case, the fact that the program expires so often means that it's a terrible thing to actually rely on. As we heard when we talked to Nuno Lamau back in episode 6, uncertainty can really dampen trade by just as much as high tariffs. So when businesses don't know what future tariffs that they're going to face, they might not actually make the investments necessary and hire the workers that they need to actually take advantage of exporting and those lower tariffs. In a separate paper, Shushanik has research in that same vein. So what she finds is that exports fall even when the U.S. GSP program is only temporarily non-renewed, as it is right now, and even when those import taxes that these companies are paid are refunded. We're not sure why, but one additional concern is that maybe these poor countries lack access to trade finance. So they aren't perhaps able to borrow the money that they need to cover their suddenly higher costs, even if only temporary, when they have to now pay these import taxes.
Alternatively, and this is only anecdotal, but it could be that the importing company can't cover the costs. The people I've been talking to have explained to me the kinds of cash flow problems that they have when suddenly they have to cover hundreds of thousands worth of tariffs. One importer I spoke to had to lay off two of his American employees in response to the tariff. Another had to eventually raise their prices, which affected demand. It's not necessarily the exporter that's having to bear all the costs of these higher tariffs. And then the extra layer of administrative hassle could just pose a problem. So again, I've spoken to importers who have had problems with the delivery companies accidentally misclassifying products and then requiring paperwork that just doesn't exist in the country of origin. So, you know, in some cases, they've just had to pay the tariff because they couldn't get the documentation to prove it. This wouldn't be a problem if it was just under WTO rules where everyone was treated the same. It wouldn't matter where it came from. This is really just a problem associated with this scheme. And then the other problem, I guess, is that these things require that a certain fraction of the parts are from that developing country, which can be hard to meet if locally they don't produce very high quality inputs. You know, there's this thing, it's called globalization. It means that often it makes sense for countries to develop supply chains that go across country barriers. You might at least want your supply chain to go across various different poorer countries. But there are some opportunities, but quite limited opportunities for essentially accumulating the content that comes from these poorer countries so it all can count to get your product eligible under this scheme.
The other problem is that these rich countries have so much choice when deciding which products to actually exclude. They end up choosing products that make sense from their perspective, but perhaps not from the developing country's perspective. So in the U.S. case, of the 50% or products that with positive MFN tariffs, so these are the products that you can actually give a preference, only about half of those end up with the United States offering them a tariff preference under GSP. And of course, they exclude the import-sensitive products. There's also some evidence that these tariff preferences might be driven more by the interests of U.S. multinationals than for the developing countries themselves. So here's Emily Blanchard again.
Foreign direct investment and multinational firm linkages and interests are a powerful determinant of who gets GSP access. For example, if there's a subsidiary in, say, Southeast Asia of a U.S. firm that's making products and then selling them back into the United States, it's more likely that that Southeast Asian country will get GSP access for the product that's being made in part by the American subsidiary.
It's worth pointing out that her results are consistent with causality running the other way too. So there could be this positive feedback effect whereby multinationals fight for lower tariffs under GSP, and then the fact that there are lower tariffs also pulls in more foreign direct investment. So it could be a win-win. But still, I guess it's not how you would hope that one of these schemes would be designed.
I think there's actually potentially an even bigger problem with these kinds of GSP schemes that might even make it that a better designed GSP type of system might not actually work. And that's because without reciprocity, you actually get some problems. So the rich countries can give poor countries low import tariffs, but in order for the poor countries' exporters to be able to grow, when there's fixed resources in these countries, so only a certain amount of labor and investment that can be made, the poor country has to actually let its import competing sectors shrink. But without reciprocity, what that means is these poor countries haven't had to let their import competing sectors shrink. They haven't had to lower their own import tariffs and other trade barriers. And the result is their import competing sectors are allowed to stay bloated, and they don't cough up the workers and the investment needed to allow these export sectors to actually grow.
So I guess another way of saying that would be that having a non-reciprocal program means that there isn't really a mechanism to lower tariffs in the poorer country, and those lower tariffs could actually be good. And by spurning any form of reciprocity, there's no way for the poorer countries to persuade the richer ones to lower tariffs to their sensitive sectors.
And there is empirical evidence of this mattering. Arvind Subramanian and Sheng Jinwei in a 2007 paper make the point that developing countries haven't been able to expand their exports of really critical sectors for them, so agriculture, footwear, clothing. Now, we're not exactly sure why. The lack of reciprocity did make it hard to get lower tariffs for these countries in the rich country markets, but part of that could be because the poor countries just never came to the bargaining table to ask for them. But it could also be in part because these same poor countries didn't actually open up their import markets to free up the labor and the investment to allow their export sectors to actually grow. So it really is still an open question, and it's likely to be some combination of both.
Okay, I get it. As a multilateralist, I guess you would think that any holes in the system are bad, and I buy the idea that we don't have brilliant evidence that this thing is transformative. So maybe the cost in terms of these long-run threats to the system outweigh the benefit of these higher exports that we see. Related to that worry, though, I guess knowing the counterfactual is quite difficult. So we don't know that if we did have reciprocity and these developing countries did sit at the negotiation table, that they would be particularly successful. It could be that once the rich countries go into sort of hard-nosed negotiating mode, they just have so much power that they force the poorer countries to do stuff that is even less in their interests than the stuff that you're talking about. So, you know, maybe US pharma companies would try and impose really tight intellectual property law on the poorer countries, which might not be such good news. I think in the short run, it's probably easier to focus on ways to improve that system. And it could look to the ways that, I guess, the EU has improved its own system. So rather than just letting the scheme lapse in the US permanently, it seems like it would just be much more sensible to expand the scope, make it permanent, not uncertain, maybe loosen some of the rules of origin. I just don't think this thing has been given a chance to work properly. And for now, some poor country exporters have an easier time finding rich country importers. Rich country consumers get cheaper stuff. That's nice. So I think you're going to have to come up with some better arguments before we just ditch this whole thing and go back to the multilateral reciprocal drawing board.
So I agree with that. And if you do want to improve the American system, a better designed one would getting rid of all this uncertainty that come along with renewals every couple of years. You'd want to increase the product coverage to allow for textiles and apparel and agriculture, get rid of these caps that limit it to only a couple $100 million of trade. You'd want to get rid of all of that stuff. But in reality, all I want for Christmas is reciprocity to be used constructively. And I think there's still some scope there to help engage developing countries more effectively in the international trading system.
I think that is as good as we are going to get. So, acknowledgements. Thanks to Kim Elliott at the Center for Global Development.
Thanks also to Emily Blanchard at the Tuck School of Business for sharing her research with us. There's a number of other economists with excellent research in this area that we read and learned about, and we'll make sure to tweet out links to their papers. That includes Shoshana Kakopayan at the IMF in Washington, Manuel Ornelas at the Sao Paulo School of Economics in Brazil, Joe van Briesburg at Catholic University of Leuven in Belgium, Shangjin Wei at Columbia Business School in New York, and Arvind Subramanian, my Peterson Institute colleague, who's now on leave and working for the Indian government.
And that is all from Trade Talks. If you have specific feedback or ideas for future episodes, then do get in touch. I'm at Sameya Keynes.
And I'm at Chad Bowne.
And we are at trade_talks.
That's not one, but two underscores. At trade_talks. Because when it comes to tariff preference programs, one simple acronym just wasn't enough. So in the US, there's GSP, AGOA. In the EU, there's GSP, GSP+, EBA.
Okay, yeah, you're not allowed to.